Well, Merry Christmas. Had my welcome to that of the others. Quickly just do the thing that we often do this time of year to find out who was up the earliest. In fact, I want to do it a little bit differently this year and find out who's the oldest person who was up the earliest. See if we can work this one out. Who was up at 5 this morning? Okay, over 30, up at 5? Okay, there's a few of you. Over 30, up at 4. We're going to be looking down here then. I see your hand. Over 40, up at 4? You're not under 40. Are you really that? Okay, over 40, up at 4. Over 45? Over 50? This is not a toilet stop we're talking about. This is up and stayed up, yeah? Oh, we won't go any longer with the age, but up at 3:30? What were you doing up at 3:30 this morning? Yeah, okay, so you didn't even go to bed, did you? You were up the whole time. Christmas has got, you've got to wear off. It's got to actually stop being as exciting for you. Okay, there you go. Christmas, it's an exciting time, and I think the kids are wrapped. Our kids are all still in bed asleep, as far as I can tell when I left home this morning. So it's worn off for them a little bit. But I want to talk to you about Christmas this morning. It's here. It's the big day. It's the day when we can gather with the meals, the presents, the family, all of that kind of deal. I don't know what you've got going on. But as we do say each Christmas, it isn't all good. And for the purposes of achieving something deeper and more wonderful than just nice feelings this morning, I want to point out something. It wasn't all good at that first Christmas either. Now, I'm going to actually ask you to do something which becomes very scary to do. I'm going to ask you to trust me on this. I want to ask you to trust me that we're going to consider something not often considered at Christmas time. And you need to trust me because I dare say we do want Christmas time, Christmas day, to be something wonderful. Is that right? We long for it. We want our kids to not only like their presents, but really appreciate the thought, the effort, the sacrifice that went into them by those that bought them for them. Yes? So they'll actually say thank you and mean it. Yes? And when you actually go to Christmas with the family, you kind of hope that there's this real meeting of lives and people are engaged together and there's this warmth and generosity and people are very grateful and thankful for whatever they get, even when it's the underpants. But people are kind of excited about the whole... You want it to be like that. You want it to be nice. You want the family to come together and it all be this wonderful time where someone doesn't finish the day walking out grumpy and unhappy. You want that to be the case Christmas time. Am I right? Friends, and so you've got all these hopes, and I dare say some of you are already nervous about the day, and you want it at least to start well. And so you want Christmas at church to be something that's warm and inspiring and encouraging and nice. And so you're already a little bit nervous because the bloke said, trust me, and you're not sure you can, and you don't know where this is going. I want to encourage you to trust me because I'm going to take us through a path that isn't often trod at Christmas time. It has some bumps on it. It's got a little bit of rough edges to it, but I am going to say it's got a destination where I hope we'll end this morning. It is a place far more wonderful than you might otherwise expect. Because I want you to notice something, and it's there in some of that reading that we had that comes out of one of the eyewitness accounts of the person of Jesus, his life, his death, and then extraordinarily his resurrection from the grave. It comes from the pen of Matthew. And he tells us that the beginnings, that very first Christmas time, weren't very smooth. He tells us in chapter 1 of this gospel, verse 18 and 19, that his conception was rocky, or at least the reaction to his conception was rocky. That is to say, Joseph found out that his fiancée was pregnant and it wasn't him. And there was devastation. He was prepared, verse 19 of this chapter, to actually didn't want to expose her to public disgrace. So he had in mind to divorce her quickly. That is enormously stressful, a difficult time. But then there's dislocation. Jesus is born on the road. at an inn, at a lean-to on the back of a small house, which was the nature of the inn back in those days. Now, I know some of you have already given up on the notion of childbirth being this romantic, idealistic, beautiful time. It's a lot of pain and so on, but not many of us would go for the birth of our children on the way to Sydney this afternoon, caught in traffic on the F3. You know what I mean? You'd want to at least go somewhere that's safe and secure. Here we have a child born, first child, born in the midst of a journey somewhere on the way, stuck. It's a terribly difficult circumstance that they're in. All of it's not smooth. But then, chapter 2, which is the passage that we read this morning, you add to this extraordinarily brutal and evil event that's recorded for us. And the whole incident becomes very, very sobering. You come to chapter 2 and you're introduced to a man called Herod, King Herod, verse 1. It's right at the very first sentence of the section that's on your sheet. He was known to us historically as Herod the Great. He was a great builder. He ruled from 40 BC to just after Jesus' birth. And because of a visit to his city, the city of Jerusalem, by a group called the Magi, he found out that there was to be born, or had been born, a king of the Jews. Now, these people were perhaps Eastern wise men, astrologers of some kind, and they'd heard that in an ancient prophecy, in various astrological things, that there was a king to be born, and they'd connected it with some of the biblical records. And you actually have, if you look there, indented in that sheet, you'll have a quote from a prophetic word written some hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus about where this man would be born. "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Here was a prophecy, a very explicit prophecy, not like Nostradamus, not like that kind of very vague. Here is a very explicit prophecy about the city, the town, where this ruler would be born. And on the basis of that, the Magi know now where to go, and so they head to this town, directed by Herod. He directs them to search and find for this baby who was born king. They do that, they go to Bethlehem, they search, they find. But instead of coming back to Herod, which is what he asked them to do, they go directly back to their homes, having been warned in a dream. Now, then happens an act of immense brutality. The reason Herod the Great had sent these Magi off to Bethlehem to search and find was that he might rid his world of this man. Now, because he now didn't know who this child was, and because it's now a little bit late in the piece, it's some many months, perhaps a year later, he chooses to actually end the lives of every child in that town 2 years and under to make sure he's covered off the one that he actually does want to have killed. It's an extraordinary event. Now, it's not the most brutal event that this man did. He was a very brutal ruler. History tells us, in fact, in one occasion he gathered 250 of the Jewish leaders to kill them. That was the nature of this man. So this wasn't extraordinarily brutal in comparison. But for each family, of whom there were probably only a dozen, it's a very small town, but for each family it was devastating, yes? Very much like Connecticut in recent weeks. If you picture the grief of that incident in America, you've got the picture of what it must have been like at that first Christmas time or around that era. It was evil. Now, I know it's horrible, and I know talking about it is horrible, and it doesn't seem to fit the modern Christmas feel that we want to try to generate together, but please trust me on raising it, because here's the thing. For us, we want happiness. We long to have a life that is at least happy. But for us, happiness can so often depend on retreating, avoiding, and ignoring. The world is a broken place, it's dark. And festivals like Christmas are for us a welcome break, a kind of respite. It's an opportunity to kind of take time, to get some rest, to kind of break ourselves free from the hurt, the pain, the stagger, the weariness, just to have an oasis where it will go well for a day. It will be warm and generous and nice for a day. And most of us are trying to just hold on, and at least for this day, we want it to be. So that when disaster actually happens at Christmas time, we feel it far more intensely, don't we? So that this might happen at Christmas time. Because we are so much seeking for some happiness in the midst of, and we want to actually have this little oasis protected for ourselves. But let me say this. Happiness that is built on retreating, avoiding, and ignoring is a very fragile kind of happiness. It is, in the end, very superficial. And Christmas offers something deeper and more wonderful and more profound. You think again how that Christmas started. It started in the midst of all the horrors of our brokenness. It happened in the midst of the kind of grief we see and feel for the families in America. It happened in the midst of the horror of pain, of loss, of grief. That was the context of Jesus' arrival. Now, if you've got a heart and you hear all of the incidents and events, not just in Connecticut, but in Afghanistan, in Syria, in all the other places of our world, if you've got a heart, and you hear of these horrors and these evils. We don't want to ever lose that word, actually. If we hear of these evils, it's got to ring from you this question, hasn't it? Why doesn't God do something? Why doesn't he end all of this? If he's so loving, why doesn't he deal with it? Do you know, Christmas is God's answer. I am dealing with it, he says. And he's dealing with it in the only way possible so that there can be hope for us who are actually part of the problem. You go back to that village in Jesus' time where Herod enacted that brutal, brutal act. You go back to that village. What caused that event? Well, yeah, it's the brutality of one man. It's his evil. But where did that come from in Herod? What led to him being like that? Well, you've got all kinds of stock answers. He had perhaps a lack of character, such that when he had absolute power, it corrupted him absolutely and created in him as he aged a great insecurity and fear. Perhaps it was because of the way he was parented. Perhaps it was some kind of psychiatric illness that he had. You've got all of these kind of stock answers. And all of them have some validity. But you can't finally explain why Herod acted like he did without recognizing there's something deeper going on. And recognizing that there's something deeper going on which explains why in all of us there's still an unrelenting problem. Why is it the case that although we affirm the truth, we slide so easily into stretching the truth, into white lies, and then into lies? Why is it although we affirm generosity, we struggle to be generous as a pattern of our lives beyond perhaps one or two days or one or two crisis moments or beyond even our family or those that we love? Why are we unable to have as a pattern beyond across? Why is it that although we agree materialism is dumb, we keep being sucked into it more and more? You know, the interesting thing last week, the Mayan calendar and the incidents of the end of the world, there was a festival in Byron Bay this last week where people prepared for the end of the world and gathered to have a festival there in celebration of its coming. And when it didn't come, there was various speakers who came and addressed the crowd. I'll tell you two of them. There was a professor of complementary medicine from the RMIT University. Some of you will know that signatory there. And he said this: the point is not to get depressed about the problems of the world, but to get a fire in the belly and use this fire to create meaning in life and create change. If we consciously create our environment, we can consciously create a Garden of Eden. We can. Another speaker spoke, an Australian man spoke, that we're on the cusp of a consciousness revolution. And he said, we need to make a decision. Am I going to live for my need or for my greed? Now, friends, it all sounds very inspiring. Yes, we can. Just make a decision, not for your greed, but for your need. But we have now had thousands of years of recorded history, and it's not getting better. The Bible is alone in its assessment that we could and should choose differently, but we won't and can't because of a root problem. A problem that is at the consequence of a choice that we have each made or an attitude that we have towards God. Listen to the words of Romans chapter 1. For although we knew God, we neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. So our thinking became futile and our minds have been darkened. As a consequence of a choice we've made towards our Creator, the Bible identifies that that's brought a brokenness into our very minds, lives, and hearts, so that our world is now living in the context of what we brought upon it, darkness and futility. And it's a condition we can't change. We can affirm the good, but we can't do it. And I'm going to throw a challenge. Here's a challenge for you. If you don't believe what I'm saying, if you are in a close relationship with someone, choose to always say what you know you should say in that relationship. Choose to always say what is helpful and not hurtful. Choose to always say something that doesn't come from pride but comes from humility and a desire for their... Choose to always do that and see how you go. Are you married? You know you can't do it. Isn't that right? You know, the Bible says, where does this come from? It comes from the fruit of neither glorifying God nor giving him thanks. We have distanced ourselves from him, and it's led to these consequences. You know, at the risk of trivializing, I have a dog, which is a really cute dog. My kids started a Facebook page and it got the most hits as the cutest dog in the world. So I'm sorry about your dog, but my dog is very cute. Well, I like playing with this dog. It's good fun. And when it suits me, I do. I'll scratch behind its ear or I'll throw something with it. But when I'm not interested, I just don't. Now, it is a dog, and that's okay, isn't it? The point the Bible makes is that we treat God like that. We engage with him when we are interested, when it suits us, when we need him. It's all right for a dog, but not for the God of the universe. You see the world of Jesus' day and our day, and in this brokenness and evil, why doesn't God act? Christmas is God acting, or at least the beginning of his action. He enters the world into the pain that we experience, and he comes to establish a context from which he can fix it. And now I'm just in a minute going to rush through some massive ideas. He is born to be one of us in the midst of our pain and grief and loss, to unite himself to us and our circumstances. And by an act at the end of his life, by his death, he absorbs upon himself the problems that we have, the consequences that are brought about by that before God and in our experiences of life because of death. He absorbs all of that into himself to provide a place of rescue so that As he promises, one day he will rebuild the universe and rid it of all that hurts and brings destruction. But by his act within our circumstances, he makes it possible for us to be rescued out of it and so be part of that new act that he will one day do. All of this seems extraordinary, except by his resurrection, he demonstrates the historic reality of it. You can know it's true. Extraordinary. Let me pull it together with three things. First, Christmas wasn't soft and nice and cuddly. It was embedded in reality, the real world of brokenness and brutality and evil. Don't think of a kid's nativity play when you think of Christmas. It wasn't like that. Second, because it happened in the context of the realities of our life, this coming of Jesus, it offers something far more than a kid's movie on a Christmas Eve. Offers something far more than just to make you feel good. It is truly dealing with life and death and brokenness and evil, the things that we rightly grieve over. God has come to deal with. And you reflect on these things at Christmas time and it's sobering. And it raises massive issues for us. Questions at the very heart of our being. Is the Bible's assessment of us true? Are we who the Bible says we are? If these things are the case, then Jesus is our only hope. But third, for those that do get this message, there is hope in the midst of horror. That child was born as a ruler. Herod was right to be afraid in one level. He was born to be the King of Kings, and his birth was the first step in God reclaiming the world to bring it back to right. God has provided the key to be rescued and reconciled to him, which is the first step in repairing the whole. Come back and be forgiven. But this therefore means, friends, in the midst of pain and horror and grief and loss and evil, there is hope. And at this point, it's poetry, isn't it, that captures it best? It's a song we are about to sing, I think, John, isn't it? Joy to the world. Oh, holy night. Listen to these words. We haven't just already sung it, have we? Oh, yeah. I can't remember the names of carols. Well, they're all very wonderful. But listen to this one. Long lay the world in sin and error pining. The Bible is captured in that line as acknowledging reality. Till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. God loves, and he has come for you. A thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. The Christian faith is so much better than sentimentality. Every experience of pain and grief confirms the Bible's verdict that we are in error and sin pining. But in the midst of that pining, there is a yonder breaking of a new and glorious morn in the birth of Jesus, which heralds his victory in death and resurrection to establish a means by which we can be brought back and secured for eternity, so that finally, when it goes wrong with you at Christmas time this Christmas, remember that it's always going to be broken. We need the work of God and thank God for a Redeemer and cling to him as he clings to you. And if you have him, rejoice that we do have a hope founded not by ignoring and avoiding the realities of life, but found in the midst of the brokenness of life, established as an historical event that you can pin your life on. The glory and greatness of Christmas time, where we don't ignore, but we find hope in the midst.